It's time.
We are not called to be nice.
Sandy Rios, welcome, Sandy. Thanks for being here.
We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
And you still like me, or you don't like me, James?
Are you okay? You all right?
I'm a musician. I can't help it.
Longtime Fox News contributor Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
We have, I think it's 4-1 youth in America wants gay marriage.
Our kids are the product of public schools. No wonder they poll the way they do.
It's time to stand up or we're going to lose everything we have.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up, speak up, say something, do something.
This isn't a game. This is real life.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association.
A pro-life radio talk show host.
Some things are worth fighting for.
For the fifth straight day, protesters have taken to cities across Iran, calling for the Iranian regime to meet their economic needs. In a sign of how unprecedented these protests are, they shouted for the Supreme Leader Ayatollah Khamenei, the nation's top Islamic cleric and protector of the 1979 revolution, to step down. From Florida, President Trump encouraged the Iranian people. Iran is failing at every level despite the terrible deal made with them by the Obama administration. The great Iranian people have been repressed for many years. They are hungry for food and for freedom. Along with human rights, the wealth of Iran is being looted. Time for change. The vice president also weighed in. As long as @RealDonaldTrump is POTUS and I am VP, the United States of America will not repeat the shameful mistake of our past when others stood by and ignored the heroic resistance of the Iranian people as they fought against their brutal regime.
So
the Prime Minister of Israel sent encouragement as well.
And when this regime finally falls, and one day it will, Iranians and Israelis will be great friends once again. I wish the Iranian people success in their noble quest for freedom.
President Obama's National Security Advisor Susan Rice scoffed at the Trump administration's approach. How can Trump help Iran's protesters? Be quiet.
Yeah, like President Obama did when the protesters were in the streets a number of years ago and so many of them were killed, imprisoned, and we shamefully stood and watched, and that they're proud of. Sandy Rios in the morning with you. That really is the biggest story right now, is the unrest in Iran. It's been going on for several days now, people on the streets. I would venture to say it's a great deal more than just that the wealth is not going to the people, although I'm sure that's part of it. But they're demanding the ouster of Ayatollah Khomeini, which is pretty amazing. And so we will talk a great deal about that tomorrow. My plan is to have an Iranian expert on so that we can actually dissect this. But, you know, just to stop a second and think about what's happening. Iran is the greatest, the largest sponsor of state terror in the entire world. Going back to the war in Iraq, you know, paying money for all those IEDs that killed and maimed so many of our men, all the terrorist activities in South and Central America through Hezbollah, all the while President Obama, you know, dismantling the team of agents that were tracking Hezbollah's cocaine trade in the United States, all of their criminal activity, disbanding that, telling them to look the other way, assigning them to other places. There was a whole squad of DEA agents assigned to tracking them. President Obama, meanwhile, is doing everything he can to help Iran. They're sending them millions of dollars in cash, helping them build up their nuclear weaponry, stopping us from going after their terrorist arm, Hezbollah. It's an amazing story. And all the while bragging about not, you know, tipping their hand when the uprising happened in the state, in the streets of Iran, what, 8 years ago, 9 years ago. It's just an amazing story. It really is. And so President Trump is weighing in on this on the side of the demonstrators. It's you would think that with all the money they had gotten from the Obama administration, that they would be in a position of strength and stability. But the people there are rising up. Some of you may not remember that Iran was once a pretty secular Muslim state. The women were in school and they dressed Western. They were very advanced, but not when the Ayatollahs took over. And so it's an amazing story, and I think the only thing we can do is just pray that the president has wisdom, that our intelligence agencies, given the assumption that they're willing Given their corruption, I'm not confident about this, but that at least the voices that are heard and the ones whose tactics prevail are those that would help the people of Iran to be free. And so that's, again, an ongoing story. We'll talk much more about it tomorrow. While we were vacationing, and by the way, I had a delightful time away. I hope that you did too. It was just wonderful to just celebrate the birth of Christ, be with friends, think about, you know, just worship and pray and enjoy time with family. It was just a great, I hope that you had the same thing and are restored and ready to jump right back in, being responsible citizens as you are, trying to keep track of what's going on and then act accordingly. And while we were vacationing, there were lots of people on the front lines. And I have to go back to a story that happened right before Christmas, and that was what happened in the United Nations when the president decided to move the embassy for Israel from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. And, of course, all hell did break forth because the UN basically has, for the last I don't know how many years, been a body of world leaders, representatives that hates America and Israel. And it's become increasingly that in the last few years. And so there's a long account of what happened in the United Nations written by Claudia Rosette for PJ Media. It's excellent. We'll put this on our Facebook page so you can read it. But let me just say the president made that announcement on December 6th. Then there was a showdown in the UN on Monday, I think, before Christmas. The 15-member Security Council with an introduction of a draft resolution by Egypt decided, you know, to condemn the United States and Israel. That would include Bolivia, Ukraine, Ethiopia, Senegal, China, Russia, France. But Nikki Haley vetoed and blocked that vote in the committee. So then they moved it to the entire UN body where they knew that the United States could not veto it. And, of course, the condemnation was amazing. I think we only had 9 allies in the final vote. The UK, Austria, Belgium, Denmark, France, Germany, Ireland, Italy, the Netherlands, Portugal, Spain, and Sweden all voted against us and against Israel, condemning us for moving our embassy to Jerusalem, which we have every right to do. So that was the drama that played out in the United Nations and how different it was to hear UN Ambassador Nikki Haley respond. Let's listen.
The arguments about the president's decision to move the American embassy to Jerusalem have already been made. They are by now well known. The decision was in accordance to U.S. law dating back to 1995, and its position has been repeatedly endorsed by the American people ever since. The decision does not prejudge any final status issues, including Jerusalem's boundaries. The decision does not preclude a two-state solution if the parties agree to that. The decision does nothing to harm peace efforts. Rather, the president's decision reflects the will of the American people and our right as a nation to choose the location of our embassy. There is no need to describe it further. Instead, there is a larger point to make. The United States will remember this day in which it was singled out for attack in the General Assembly for the very act of exercising our right as a sovereign nation. We will remember it when we are called upon to once again make the world's largest contribution to the United Nations. And we will remember it when so many countries come calling on us, as they so often do, to pay even more and to use our influence for their benefit. America will put our embassy in Jerusalem. That is what the American people want us to do, and it is the right thing to do. No vote in the United Nations will make any difference on that. But this vote will make a difference on how Americans look at the UN and on how we look at countries who disrespect us in the UN. And this vote will be remembered. Thank you.
All right, that was Nikki Haley. She had a lot more to say, all of it good. And so in the days following that, what happened? Well, let's just say Nikki Haley announced that the United States would reduce its funding for the UN by $285 million. So take that. Of course, we pay for most of it. We house them in New York. The diplomats come over and they have a wonderful cushy time. They have immunity from our national law. They can do they can do traffic violations. They can even murder people. They don't get they have immunity. from our law. Usually they're just deported if they do something really horrible. And they live in luxury in New York City, paid for the most part, by our tax dollars. And so finally, someone is doing something about the ridiculous body which has become known as the United Nations. That's not it. That's not all of it, though. Over the Christmas holidays, a friend of mine was in Jerusalem, and she sent me a picture. On every street corner in Jerusalem, there was this big sign from Jerusalem. The wording was something like, from Jerusalem to the United States, Jerusalem, thank you, Mr. Trump. Thank you, Mr. Trump. And that's what that was there. It was just amazing on every city block. And as a matter of fact, Israel is going to name a train station near Jerusalem's Western Wall after President Donald Trump. So it's amazing. And so that's it, but even broadens. We have a story about Pakistan. Let's see. Maybe I'll have Steve Harrigan tell you this story. I think it's Steve. Yes, let's listen to clip four because the president isn't finished. Let's listen.
10 days of golf in the Florida sun did nothing to take the edge off the president's Twitter feed, which began the new year with a blistering critique of the U.S. relationship with Pakistan. The United States has foolishly given Pakistan more than $33 billion in aid over the last 15 years, and they have given us nothing but lies and deceit, thinking of our leaders as fools. They give safe haven to the terrorists we hunt in Afghanistan with little help. No more. The initial response from Pakistan was muted. The foreign minister responded on Twitter, "We will respond to President Trump's tweet shortly, inshallah. We'll let the world know the truth, difference between facts and fiction." Relations between Pakistan and the U.S. have soured in recent months, particularly after Pakistan reportedly refused to hand over one of the captors of an American woman, Caitlin Coleman, held by the Taliban for 5 years with her Canadian husband and children. A National Security Council official told Fox News that as of now, the U.S. is not planning to send a scheduled $255 million in aid to Pakistan.
All right, so there you go. Listen, I love this. This is right. It's just right what the president is doing, and Nikki Haley is his voice in the UN, and I thank God for her, and I thank God for him, too. And so, now, we heard a story at the top of the hour. I was going to play news report, but I'll just tell you, to save a little time here, that the transgender and the military issue is still so much in flux. The president, of course, wrote an order, I think it was back in August, precluding the recruitment of transgender individuals by the Pentagon. But, of course, the courts got involved. And also, the Pentagon got involved because the Pentagon doesn't want to stop recruiting transgender troops. The Pentagon is infiltrated with the LGBT activists. And so here we are, January 2nd, then, because of the courts staying the executive order, transgender persons can now enter the military. And, of course, we know the cost of surgery is absolutely astronomical. It can be up to $100,000, and we also know that in the last few months, when they have paid for some of these surgeries, they don't do it on base. They've hired private entities. They've sent them to other doctors outside of the network, as it were, and paid for it with your tax dollars. So that's the nonsense that's going on, the dangerous nonsense. Well, some people are trying to do something about it. Let me just say a letter from Attorney General Edwin Meese, Commander-in-Chief of the Pacific Fleet Admiral James Lyons, who's been a guest on our show. Lieutenant General Jerry Boykin, you know well, Thomas McInerney, Frank Gaffney, and Elaine Donnelly all have signed a letter to the president and also to the heads of the national security about how to stop this and how to issue another directive. Do not let, they're asking, the courts determine and limit you on your executive orders. You are the commander-in-chief. You have this authority. There's a lot more detail about that, and we'll be talking about that later as well. There's a lot of information, as you can imagine, having since we've been off. And when we return, I want to turn our attention to this whole issue of DACA, amnesty, immigration, the wall, and all of it, because Congress is moving full steam ahead, the leadership of both houses, Republicans, to, you know, help you by making illegal immigrants free. It's an amazing story to me, and we're going to tell it. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
Hey, here's some great news, and we could all use some great news for 2018. If you're worried about your healthcare costs or you feel like you're missing out because open enrollment is over, well, it's not too late to join MediShare. You can sign up anytime. And think about this. The typical savings for a family with MediShare is about $500 a month. Think what a difference that would make to your budget. Again, that $500 a month is the typical savings. It could be more or less for you. Definitely worth taking a couple minutes to find out. There are over 300,000 MediShare members sharing each other's medical bills, and something they're now loving, MediShare has a telehealth program that lets you log in and meet with a doctor in real time within the comfort of your own home. For everything from a cold or flu or for a prescription, you can save a lot of time and money, and it's free. Again, open enrollment might be over, but you can still join MediShare. Here's the number to find out more. 855-PSALM-23. That's 855-PSALM-23. 855-PSALM-23.
This is Life Issues with Brad Mattis, president of Life Issues Institute.
19-year-old Karina's family was devastated. Doctors in Denmark told them she was brain dead after a car accident. The family agreed to remove the ventilator and gave an okay to harvest her organs. But when they took away the ventilator, Karina continued to breathe and is making progress toward recovery. The situation received considerable attention, and as a result, over 500 people removed their names from the organ donor register. A similar situation to Karina's plays out frequently in America. Experts admit the criteria for brain death is subjective and varies from state to state. If you'd like more information to help protect your health or that of a family, visit lifeissues.org and click on the microphone icon for free resources. Be equipped and educated.
Like us on Facebook at Life Issues and stay informed, more informed than you've ever been.
Hello, Americans. I'm Todd Starnes with news and commentary next.
Truett McConnell University.
So my name is Atara. I'm a senior and my major is psychology. I love Truett. Maybe a lot of other schools out there. You can go to bigger schools. You can go to schools that's way far away from home. But in the end, one of the things that I realize is that God called me here, and that's why Truett is the perfect place for me. And if God called you here, then it's the perfect place for you also.
Are you called? Visit Truett.edu today.
A former Baptist turned agnostic is suing a Louisiana school district claiming they promote Christianity. Christy Cole filed a federal lawsuit against the Webster Parish School District. She cited 30 incidents alleging the unconstitutional use of religion in the classroom. Ms. Cole says one science teacher called evolution a fairy tale, and another was seen holding a Bible. Oh my! She also alleges Christian prayers were delivered at sporting events and pep rallies and graduations ceremonies. The school district has not commented on the lawsuit. It should be noted the American Civil Liberties Union has joined the case. They accuse the school district of heavy-handed religious indoctrination. Although, if in fact a teacher did tell students that evolution is a fairy tale, well, it may be that Webster Parish has employed some of the best school teachers in America. I'm Todd Starnes.
Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
Sandy Rios back with you. Well, something else happened while we've been vacationing. January 1st, became a sanctuary state. They've actually put it up on their signs. Welcome to the state of California. So someone has been paying for additions to this sign. Somebody who has money and the means has added a plaque. I'm sure he's going to get himself in trouble, but it says official sanctuary state. Felons, illegals, and MS-13, welcome. Democrats need the votes. It's a sign that looks just like the Welcome to the California sign. It's pretty amazing. So, of course, they're ignoring federal law, and they've declared themselves a sanctuary state. Daniel Horowitz wrote an interesting article during the break titled More Chain Migration, Islamic Terrorism, More Media Blackout. And then he talks about, he tracks another over Christmas weekend, how another chain migrant from an Islamic country was arrested for plotting a terror attack against the very country that admitted him. And then he talks about another one. Well, this is Ahmed El-Mofti, an immigrant from Egypt who later became a naturalized citizen, targeted Harrisburg, Pennsylvania police in a series of shootings in three separate locations on Friday. And then it was confirmed that he was a beneficiary of chain migration from a distant relative. He was brought here. Then he tracks another one, Pakistan-born woman Zubia Shanaz, who was charged earlier this month with laundering Bitcoin in a scheme to raise money for ISIS. She was also brought over here through chain migration. And then Iqaed Ula, who was the New York bomber from Bangladesh, came through chain migration. And Daniel writes, almost every day since the New York bombing, I've seen stories of Islamic migrants or children of Islamic migrants in cities, towns across the great nation arrested on terrorism charges. Yet it is buried by mainstream media publications. It's no longer newsworthy that America is becoming like Europe. Our prisons are filled with Islamic terrorists arrested here at home. The New York Times reported last week that Ahmed Khamed Rahimi, the convicted Chelsea bomber from last year, who injured 30 people in a terror attack, is already radicalizing fellow inmates in a Manhattan prison. And then he goes through and tracks the number of migrants from the Middle East who are coming in through chain migration, and it is pretty shocking. And yet, this, I think, is even the more shocking. We know that the leadership in the House and in the Senate are eagerly laying the groundwork right now for a major immigration deal. They've been trying this for decades now. Decades. When they just say Dreamers, the Dream Act, trust me, it's not just Dreamers they're trying to make legal in this country. I know something about this, but our guest knows a great deal more than I do. Mark Kerkorian with the Center for Immigration Studies joins us this morning. Happy New Year, Mark.
Happy New Year.
All right, so...
And Merry Ninth Day of Christmas, by the way.
Thank you. Yes, it was a Merry Ninth Day Eve last night, and we did celebrate with gifts and everything. Mark, I don't even know where to begin. I think I'm a little bit taken aback that there's a renewal to even do, I would say... All right, maybe I'm wrong about this, but my impression is that they want to go for comprehensive immigration reform again.
Well, I mean, the people who have been pushing this, the usual suspects, Gang of Eight and the rest of them, obviously always want that. I mean, they always want to amnesty everybody and massively increase immigration. But, you know, with this president, that's not, I mean, it wasn't possible even before this president. But this DACA issue does present a real opportunity, I think. It's a danger and an opportunity. The danger is that the president might cave, Congress will pass a amnesty. It won't be the full amnesty for everybody, but remember, if you're talking about a Dreamer amnesty, that could be as many as 3 million people. The DACA issue specifically is a subset. Those are the people who got work permits from Obama's illegal amnesty program for people who came before they turned 16. Amnestying just them, now I say just, it's 700,000 people, so it's not nothing, but it's still a relatively small share of the illegal population. If we get something substantial in return, like curbs on chain migration and E-Verify, then it would be worth it, frankly. You know, we need to. How are we going to get that stuff through the Senate, since everything has to get 60 votes at this point? So this is a danger that we'll just end up with an amnesty and nothing else, which will just cause more illegal immigration and more chain migration. But it's an opportunity to trade a relatively small amnesty for really important reforms that will have long-lasting impact.
But, Mark, you know, from what I'm reading, I don't see any senator. Now, the House is different, sort of. I don't see any senator championing some smaller, maybe Tom Cotton.
Yeah, Tom Cotton.
But otherwise, you know, Jeff Flake is real excited about all of this, and they're envisioning all the things they ever wanted to do. And I think I just read that he says... that Mitch McConnell has agreed to a cloture vote on this in the month of January. Okay, so cloture vote on what? I don't know. I guess there's no real piece of legislation. But whatever it might be, they would need 60 votes. Do you think there's 60 votes to move ahead and consider this broad spectrum of immigration proposals in the Senate?
Well, it's hard to say. It's entirely possible. It's more possible than it's ever been, I think, partly because the president is for this, and the president hasn't used the word veto yet, but he's been pretty clear that anything legalizing, properly legalizing the DACA people who already have these work permits that will start expiring in March, and he's for legalizing them, but he said any bill has to include ends to chain migration and the visa lottery, that makes it a lot more likely they're going to be able to pick up a few Democrats. And the question is, how badly do the Democrats want to fix the status of these relatively young people? They're not kids anymore. They're all in their 20s and 30s. But people who spent, you know, most of their life here, they came here as kids. Do the Democrats really want to fix their problem with an amnesty if that means that we're going to have curbs on chain migration, lower legal immigration in the future? And we're going to see whether they actually want that or whether they just want to use these young people as political props.
Well, I think, of course, the answer is B. I don't think there's any question about that.
But that's okay. But, you know, I mean, in a sense, look, they're illegal immigrants. I mean, I'm for amnestying them if we get something substantial in return. But I think there's still a political benefit for Republicans. If, for instance, the House passes a good bill that amnesties these people, I mean, that's there. I don't like it. But, you know, that's the price. In exchange for getting rid of the lottery, getting rid of these chain migration categories, mandating use of the free E-Verify system for new hires, all of those things are packaged together in a bill that Dave Brat, Congressman Brat from Virginia, the one who beat Eric Cantor, he's put that together. If House passes something like that and the Democrats in the Senate kill it, even it seems to me that's a very powerful argument for Republicans saying, look, we want to play ball. We want to meet them halfway. But they're simply unreasonable, and they're willing to sacrifice these young people in order to keep legal immigration blasting along at 1.1, 1.2 million people a year. That seems like not a bad argument to go into the 2018 midterms with if the Democrats don't want to play ball.
So, Mark, at this point, that proposal by Congressman Brat is limited to the select DACA group, the 700,000.
Right.
It doesn't
go
broader than that. All right, so this, the other question is, you didn't mention funding for a wall. And as I recall, that was part of one of the things that President Trump laid down as another stipulation to do this.
Right.
Right?
Yeah, exactly. And for me, I mean, the reason I didn't mention it, because for me it's not really even in my top three issues, honestly, because you know, there's a lot more things that are more important than that. The wall, we already have some wall. We could use more of it, but it's not really my number one issue. But for the president, it is. And ironically, and like, I mean, just to preface that, the president has said it needs to be, the wall funding needs to be in there too. Ironically, the Democrats are not using the advantage that gives them. If they had any sense, they would say, okay, Mr. President, we'll fund all the wall you want if you give us X, Y, and Z. And I think the president would cave and give them all kinds of stuff he shouldn't give them because he wants the wall so badly. The Democrats are so deranged about the president, they can't even use that as an advantage against him because their own base won't allow them to fund the wall. You know, in a sense, if I were the Democrats, if I were Chuck Schumer, and he's probably already thought of this, he just can't get away with it, is I'd say, look, here, have all the wall you want, Mr. President. Just give us more amnesty. You want more wall? Give us, you know, more amnesty. We'll give you more wall. I think the president would agree to that, and that would be bad, in my opinion. In a sense, we are saved from that kind of bad deal by the Democrats' deranged approach to President Trump.
Interesting. Well, all right. Back in the House, where Paul Ryan is still Speaker, and we both know that he's been an advocate of a lot of amnesty, that
sure.
He actually went on the road, you know, with Luis Gutierrez. That always galls me. I mention it often because he's socialist leftist, and Paul Ryan traveled with him advocating for some very bad things on immigration. So do you think that Paul Ryan would be content with a Dave Brat bill that limits chain migration and limits the amnesty to just the members, the DACA recipients?
Yeah, I mean, would it be his first choice? No. Paul Ryan really is a Jack Kemp, open borders, literally let anyone who wants to move here, who isn't the criminal, type of guy on immigration. So that's, there's no question about that. But he's also a politician. He also has to run the House of Representatives. So, you know, I think he could, in the end, support a deal like that. You know, it wouldn't be his first choice, clearly. And he may not even be all that enthusiastic about it. But it's a real, I think it's a real possibility. I mean, I think this, like I said, there are real opportunities here. We should look at how we can take them rather than just assume that we're going to lose. Look, we're conservatives. We assume that, you know, we always assume the worst. It's always probably the best policy. But there's a chance here to get something good out of it. And I think we need to work on that and push in that direction.
So, Mark, you've already said this, but I just want to reiterate, knowing what you know about how out of control our immigration system is, you think the thing, the most effective things to staunch the bleeding would be to stop? Now, you're talking about stopping chain migration completely?
Well, I mean, this chain migration means two things. I mean, just in a sociological sense, it just means some immigrant comes to join family members. You know what I mean? But the chain migration categories in our law are those that let in relatives who would then be able to bring in other relatives. So if you marry, if you're an American and you adopt a baby from Colombia, or you marry somebody, you meet somebody from Vietnam and marry them, that's not really chain migration, because if there's no other categories, then that's the end of it. But the categories we have in our law now on top of that is brothers and sisters of earlier immigrants, adult children, parents, all of those people have their own relatives that these categories would then allow to immigrate. The goal would be to get rid of those other categories so that family immigration is just nuclear family, mom, dad, and little kids, and that's it. And that would, in fact, end chain migration if we could get that.
So then, and would you do, okay, this is off the subject a little bit, but would you address the legal immigration system? Would you start making big changes there, too?
Well, that is, I mean, that is part of the, that's the biggest change to the legal immigration system, is getting rid of those chain migration categories. There's other things, too.
Like merit-based.
Employment-based or skills-based, they call it, part of immigration. And that's something the president has championed, too. Senator Cotton has, in something called the RAISE Act, to change the way we do it. That's important. I'm all for it. But what they're suggesting, what Senator Cotton is suggesting, wouldn't lower those numbers. It would just change the way we do it. It would definitely be an improvement. But for me, the first job one has to be stopping chain migration, because that basically becomes a kind of self-driving process where yesterday's immigrants decide who tomorrow's immigrants will be, rather than government policy deciding that. And it basically takes it out of our control. That's the first thing in legal immigration that has to be fixed.
Mark, I wanted to say publicly, if we could go 5 minutes longer than we had anticipated, I'm going to jump into some other stuff here. You know, I remember in a conversation you and I had some time ago, you had this other idea, which I thought was great, and that was addressing the whole issue of citizenship, language, assimilation. Is that something that you, I'd love for you to explain that to my listeners again, but the second question would be, do you have that in writing, and have you proposed that to this president?
I'm not sure specifically what it was I was proposing, but was it dual citizenship? Is that what you're asking about?
No, you're talking about a system of actually actively doing more to assimilate them into the culture in terms of language and history and knowledge and all of that.
Right, especially as part of the citizenship process. Well, the first thing you do for assimilation, the first issue has to be lower the numbers. Because even if we screw up everything else, if the numbers are smaller, the damage is less. So first thing is numbers have to be brought down. What that also does is it enables immigrant communities to start getting absorbed, because there aren't new people constantly coming, and the natural forces in our society that will work for assimilation are allowed to work. In the citizenship process, this is one of the places you can really, I think, push the issue of Americanization. And because now what we do for citizenship is you have to answer 6 out of 10 questions correctly about history and government, and there's a limited 100 questions you pick from. So really, I mean, how much do you really have to know to be able to answer that? I think that needs to be tightened up and made kind of somewhat more demanding. The point is not to flunk more people, but rather to get people who are going to become Americans to learn more about it beyond George Washington was the father of our country and Lincoln freed the slaves. You have to know that stuff, but that's pretty much all you have to know in order to be able to pass the citizenship test now, not much more. And we need to be a little more demanding if we're going to accord something as important as U.S. citizenship to people.
Yes, I'd love to see you pitch that to the administration. I've got a couple of more things I want to just kind of unrelated but interesting. I just read a few days ago that the Department of Justice under Jeff Sessions wants the Census Bureau to add a question on the census as to whether or not people are citizens. First of all, it's kind of shocking that that question's not there, but I'd like to know your thoughts about that.
Sure. I mean, you know, what a lot of people want to know is, well, who are the illegal aliens? But you can't have a question in the census as, are you an illegal alien or not? I mean, who the heck is going to check that? But if you do it the way you're suggesting, in other words, are you a U.S. citizen or not, it doesn't mean you're saying you're illegal. You could be a green card holder. In other words, but it's important for purposes of representation in the legislature, because the way it works now is every warm body is counted toward apportioning House members among the states, which means California, for instance, has many more, not many, but a number of more, I mean, we've done the research on this, more representatives in Congress because the illegal immigrants and even legal immigrants are all counted for purposes of giving them seats, which means other states lose out because there's only so many members in Congress. So I think this would be an important thing to try to do so we could get an idea of where the actual citizens, which is to say potential voters, are, as opposed to people who aren't citizens, whether they're legal or not legal.
Okay, and last but not least, and this is not least, Stephen Miller, I was just reading an article by Axios saying that Stephen Miller used to be the immigration guru for Jeff Sessions when he was in Senate. We both know that. And now he's still in the White House, and we see his fingerprints and sometimes his words behind much of what President Trump says. What do you think about that, and what do you think about his position there at the White House, Mark? And good news or bad news?
Oh, no, it's clearly good news, but I think people can exaggerate. Some people on the other side say, well, you know, Trump doesn't really believe any of this stuff. It's just, you know, Stephen Miller pulling his strings, as though a guy, 30-year-old guy, is going to be telling a guy like Donald Trump what to do. The fact that Stephen Miller is there is very important because he provides the information, the language, the background for the president. But the president believes this stuff. There was just another Axios article. I just tweeted it out a few minutes ago where the reporter was saying, you know, the president is a true believer on this immigration stuff, not just on the wall, but even on legal immigration. So what Stephen Miller's role is to make sure that the president's instincts, which are already there, are able to be put into words and put policy specifics onto them. But it's not like Stephen Miller is, you know, telling the president what to do. That's a ridiculous idea.
It kind of is. When you think about everybody that's worked with the president knows he has a mind of his own.
Right.
30 seconds, Mark. January 19th, the drop dead date now. Can you tell me 30 seconds what you think is going to happen?
With what?
The budget and the DACA and all of
it. Oh, I see, DACA. Yeah, well, I mean, I think they're going to punt. I don't think they're going to put it in this spending bill. They might, but I think they've got till March, so I think they're going to punt and try to deal with it in a separate bill, in February.
Very interesting, and I bet you we'll be talking about that some more before it's over with. Mark Krikorian, Center for Immigration Studies, one of the nation's treasures. Thanks, Mark. Thanks for joining me.
Bye.
All right, Sandy Rios in the morning, coming up next.
From whom the whole body, fitly joined together and compacted by that which every joint supplieth. My name is Abraham Hamilton III, and this is the Hamilton Corner. It's not by chance that Jesus refers to his church as the body. Just as it is with our physical bodies, every member has a distinct role and function to fulfill. Unfortunately, in this era of celebrity Christianity, we've reduced the concept of ministry solely to what occurs in what is often little more than Sunday productions and performances. The key to thriving in God's kingdom is understanding that every member in the body of Christ is vital and is called to ministry.
Listen to the Hamilton Corner, weekdays from 5 to 6 p.m. Central on AFR. For more from Abraham Hamilton III, public policy analyst for the American Family Association.
Dove, of Dove Soap, they released an ad with a transgender mother as part of its new Real Moms campaign celebrating motherhood. Now, I hate to point out the obvious here.
Janet Mefford.
But a guy can't be a mother. I don't care if you wear a wig and put on a dress and talk in a high voice and put on makeup. It doesn't make you a woman to be a man being a woman who isn't really a woman. You can't conceive a baby with two women. This is just madness. Join me for Janet Mefford Live, weekdays at noon Central on American Family Radio.
Hey family, this is Lauren from Living Life with Lauren, and I want you to know just how much I appreciate you, and I count it an honor and a privilege to bring you interviews weekly with godly speakers, teachers, and authors that point us all to a closer walk with Jesus. Thank you for listening, telling your friends, downloading our podcast, and of course, connecting with me on Facebook, Living Life with Lauren, and Lauren Kitchen Stewart. I would love to hear from you. We're heard every Saturday evening at 8 Central Time on American Family Radio. Join us.
Here for your encouragement and your walk with God. This is David Wolin with Haven Ministries, inviting you to anchor your day in God's Word. Can you believe another year has gone by? I only just got used to writing 2017 on my checks, and there's no telling what 2018 will hold. But one thing you can count on is change, because in this world, change is a constant. Amid the shifting sand, though, there is one thing that never changes, and that is the solid rock of Jesus Christ. Colossians 2:7 says, "Let your roots grow down into him. Let your lives be built on him. Then your faith will grow strong in the truth, and you will overflow with thankfulness." Roots, they say, are the strength of a tree. And likewise for the Christian, rooted into Christ, we can stand firm in an ever-changing world. Get daily encouragement with Anchor Devotional. Visit getanchor.com.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Nearly 40 years ago, Sharia supremacists violently overthrew the Shah of Iran. Ever since, their regime has explicitly and relentlessly sought to bring death to America. Barack Obama nonetheless enabled this threat to grow exponentially in his pursuit of one of history's most strategically reckless policies. First, he spurned the appeals of Iranians who took to the streets in 2009 seeking freedom from the Ayatollah's tyranny. Then, his outrageous Obama bomb deal propped up the oppressors who crushed that green movement by providing diplomatic legitimation, sanctions relief, a $150 billion windfall, and a clear path to the acquisition of nuclear weapons a bit later, if not quite soon. Today, Iranian protesters are once again taking to the streets. Fortunately for them and for us this time, Donald Trump is joining their call for regime change. Now, let's help them do it. This is Frank Affney.
Don't forget to connect with Sandy Rios in the Morning on Facebook or email Sandy at sandy@afr.net. That's sandy@afr.net. Sandy Rios in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Among its most effective initiatives, the Trump administration has withdrawn, delayed, rescinded, and dismantled significant federal regulations on the environment, financial system, and economy. The Conservative Competitive Enterprise Institute says the Federal Register, in pages, is now about a third smaller from the record the Obama administration set in 2016, and is the lowest count since 1993.
We've got a lot of the rules and regulations, and people suffered from that to a certain extent, too, in all fairness. But a lot of the regulations were voided.
Nearly a year ago, President Trump signed an executive order requiring agencies to rescind two regulations for every new rule they plan to issue. The White House says the Trump administration actually cut 22 regulations for every new one and froze 1,500 Obama-era rules.
It's very tough to roll things back. So in that respect, what I think is that with respect to a president acting alone within the rule of law, Trump has done the best that I think a president could reasonably be expected to do.
While the Trump administration has aggressively targeted President Obama's environmental regulations, federal courts have slowed this administration, and litigation will likely continue against the president's agenda. Investors say businesses have largely approved of the Trump administration's unilateral success in downsizing federal rules, though it is unclear whether it can continue its pace this year without more support from Congress.
There are certain elements in 2018 that could present some trickier problems. I think NAFTA reform is an issue that's fraught with potential problems for the investment community. And so the White House is going to want to be really careful there in terms of how they handle that.
And Democrats who say they'll challenge this administration.
They say they're getting rid of regulation, they're getting rid of protections. They make it easier to pollute the air our children breathe and the water our children drink. They've dismantled net neutrality that protects consumers and entrepreneurs.
Well, you have to understand, Sandy Rios back with you. Regulations just became exponential under Barack Obama. Unbelievable, where people and businesses and other areas couldn't even hardly breathe. Does anybody remember that SWAT team raiding the Gibson guitar factory? That happened early on in the Obama administration. They sent a SWAT team in because Gibson Guitar was using some kind of wood in the manufacture of their guitars that was violating not American law, but some international law. It was amazing. I'll never forget hearing firsthand the man who ran the company at the time talking about how frightening the guns and then the harassment of his family. And, of course, that's just one story. There were stories like that. There were exponential that happened. Some many people, members of the Tea Party, will remember the IRS coming after them. I just had a lunch New Year's Day with some people that were involved with a Tea Party in a certain area of the country, and both of them very well successful in their businesses, high level, high ranking, and they were audited for 2 years in a row, and it scared them to death, and it was about, this is what happened under Barack Obama. So under President Trump, these regulations, and of course the IRS also, that's a different thing as opposed to regulations, but the regulations were strangling people, and even regulations were criminalizing people for things that they were doing on their own property, people with farmland, the water regulations. They were charging them like hundreds of thousands of dollars for alleged abuses of some sort of rules. It was just an amazing story. And so that in itself is something to be grateful for, that Hillary Clinton was not elected. Because I guarantee you, if she'd been elected, it would have been the same rules and regulations, the same strangling of private industry and individuals. Because the whole idea is central control, central control, central control. And that happens by regulation. I want to read you another article. This is written by James Dellingpole. Christmas is here. EPA officials are leaving in droves. And this is the article. According to the New York Times, more than 700 people have left the Environmental Protection Agency since President Trump took office. A wave of departures that puts the administration nearly a quarter of the way toward its goal of shrinking the agency to levels last seen during the Reagan administration. And he writes, "What marvelous news to ease us all into the festive Christmas spirit, eh, readers?" And then, of course, he says, this is not exactly the way the New York Times sees it. They report it this way. Within the agency, science in particular is taking a hard hit. More than 27% of those who left this year were scientists, including 34 biologists or microbiologists, 19 chemists, 81 environmental engineers and environmental scientists, and more than a dozen toxicologists, and on it goes. But Dellingpole goes on to spell out the reasons why it's really good news. He ends it this way. The EPA was an unaccountable agency promulgating a massive lie to the detriment of the American people, their freedoms, and their livelihoods. Donald Trump has given America a good many reasons to celebrate Christmas. His defanging of the EPA might well be the greatest one of them all. We'll put this on our Facebook page. It's Christmas is here, everyone. EPA officials are leaving in droves, and we'll put that on our Facebook page. Meanwhile, a lot of Obama officials, according to the Wall Street Journal, have decided to run for Congress. It's their first time to enter any kind of race, but they're very upset to see their rules and regulations and things that they had their hands in reversed so handily by President Trump. They're upset and they're motivated. And so many of them, I think, how many? It's at least a dozen former aides and policy staff who worked for President Obama have decided to run in the midterm races. So let's see. The numbers are these. The Cook Political Report rates 63 GOP-held seats as competitive to some degree. 17 are toss-ups and 46 a likely or lean Republican. The Democrats have to play defense on also. 21 Democratic seats are competitive, including 4 toss-ups. So the Democrats would need to win a net 24 seats to take back the majority in the House, and of course that's what they're trying to do. And this group of former Obama staffers have formed a network, and they're working together to try to defeat these members of Congress. So it's not just to turn back regulations, though. According to the Washington Post, and this is the Washington Post, this is the title, forget what they say, House Democrats are readying for impeachment. And they go through and track the reasons why the Washington Post believes that's the case. In fact, like with John Conyers stepping down from the Judiciary Committee in the House, they've replaced him with Gerald Nadler, who is a constitutional law expert. And the Post says that's because they want to prepare themselves for impeaching the president, and they want a constitutional law expert on the Judiciary Committee, which would be the one that would hear the would decide about impeachment of the president. So the leaders in the House, of course, are telling their members not to talk about it because they think people will be offended. Maybe it's just they might think it's a little too much to go after the president in impeachment, but that's exactly what they intend to do. Catherine Herridge talked about, by the way, an update on the FBI and all those investigations. There's a lot to say about that, and I'll probably spend more time on that tomorrow. But I want you to hear what Catherine had to say just last night. Let's listen.
Justice Department Inspector General Michael E. Horowitz began his investigation into the handling of the Clinton email case a year ago this month, and his findings that could become public at any time may create new obstacles for Special Counsel Robert Mueller. While the Horowitz investigation is separate from the Russia probe, it is having a direct impact. IG investigators discovered the anti-Trump text messages between FBI agent Peter Strzok and FBI lawyer Lisa Page, with whom he was having an extramarital affair. Strzok and Page were reassigned by Mueller, but the president's ally seized on the text as evidence of political bias. The IG is also investigating former Attorney General Loretta Lynch and former FBI Director James Comey, who leaked memos to the media documenting his meetings with President Trump. In recent congressional testimony, the new FBI director hinted at the potential weight of the IG findings.
When we make mistakes, there are independent processes like that of the outside independent inspector general that will drive and dive deep into the facts surrounding those mistakes. And when that independent fact-finding is complete, we will hold our folks accountable if that's appropriate.
The IG is also investigating whether Deputy FBI Director Andrew McCabe, who testified last month behind closed doors, should have recused himself from the Clinton probe because his wife received more than $700,000 from Democrats. McCabe wants to retire in March when he's eligible for full benefits, but the IG report may impact the time.
All right, that was Catherine Herridge, and that's just a little bit of it. Of course, you know, we'll be talking about that at length and explaining the latest updates on that investigation. Well, thank you for joining me this morning. Happy 2018. And as we look forward to whatever God brings into each of our lives and into this country, we'll be faithful, right? Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast do not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.